Once upon a dark night that lasts forever, here comes a man named the Snow Ghost to shine some light.
This is the Snow Ghost Community Podcast. The Snow Ghost, Bruce Russell.
And I'm Mike Benedetti. Welcome everyone back to the Community Podcast. Today on the show, on our panel, we have Adam Vellani. Hello, Adam.
Hi there. My name's Adam Vellani.
And our special guest today is Mark Benedetti, who I know from his culture studies work at Indiana University, as well as from his being my little brother. Hi, Mark. Hi, Mark. How's it going?
It's going all right. How are you guys?
Okay.
Hey, Mark. How's it going?
It's going all right.
Everybody just says hello to each other. So, Mark, your dissertation might be called What Can a Canon Do?
That's right.
Let's start off by defining what this means by canon. Because I was talking to someone, a master's graduate the other day, about what can a canon do. And this person was like, what are you talking about, canon? You mean like Paco Bell's canon? What is a canon?
A canon is usually means a body of texts, and usually implicitly, sometimes explicitly, a body of the writers of those texts that are considered the best of that form.
So, like, if you were to say the canonical American films would be like Citizen Kane, It's a Wonderful Life, maybe?
Right.
Things like this?
Yeah, sure.
What are the films that you need to have seen to be considered literate in a subject?
In American film, there are many.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm saying, in general, or the canonical literary works
not
would
even,
be Shakespeare.
Yeah, I mean, canonical means even more than just literate, because there's probably films you would have to have seen to be considered literate that don't necessarily count in the canon.
Okay. Like Independence Day.
I only saw Independence Day recently and considered myself literate before that, but yeah, sure.
Now you realize how wrong you were.
Now that you've seen it, you realize you were illiterate all along. Sure, yeah. No, it completely changed all my ideas.
Not really.
So when you're looking at what can a canon do, are you talking about canons in general, or are you talking about specific canons?
Sort of specific canons, but more canons of specific kinds of cultural formations.
Okay.
Specifically underground, what I'm calling underground cultural formations.
Okay.
So not every canon in the world. Different canons work somewhat differently.
So tell me about these canons tell me about these underground cultural formations.
Well, in my dissertation, I'm using the word underground to refer to cultural formations that sort of combine elements of what Peter Berger calls the historical avant-gardes with elements of subcultures.
Okay.
From cultural studies theory.
These undergrounds are people who are out of the mainstream or who see themselves sort of at the advanced edge of culture, and they have a community around that.
More or less, yes.
So now I understand totally what your dissertation is about. That's awesome.
Although Berger's definition of avant-garde is more precise than that, but yeah.
Okay.
If it's something to do with the culture, is there any relation to the occult?
Bits and pieces, Kenneth Anger.
Yeah,
oh, that's cool then.
So get into Kenneth Anger. So you're specifically talking about the canons of what?
I'm specifically talking about the canons of specifically 60s underground cinema, primarily centered in New York. But that canon also extends backwards through the previous history of experimental film. And then the sort of pseudo-canon of 70s punk rock in New York, and then the sort of non-canon 70s no-wave film in New York.
Okay.
What was that last one you said? 70s no-wave film?
Are we talking about like that really slow Jim Jarmusch movie? Like the really, really slow one? What is
like,
that?
Like Strangers in Paradise or Permanent Vacation?
Permanent Vacation.
Yeah, Permanent Vacation was kind of the first Jarmusch is sort of the no-wave guy who kept having a career in film, and B, became like a known guy as a filmmaker. Pretty much all the other no-wave filmmakers went off to do something else.
What have you figured out about looking at like all these subcultures, which kind of, and you kind of think of these as not being oriented towards having a canon, right? I mean, or not being oriented towards like, I guess, high culture? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is one of the tensions, is that avant-gardism historically and subcultures as well to some degree reject, you know, art institutions, in some ways reject the notion of art, although there's a great tension within them between art and popular culture, art and folk art, and that kind of thing. And so, yeah, in general, they try to reject the concept of high and low culture and a divide between high and low culture, although in certain ways they re-instantiate it.
They're saying in our community, we're not going to recapitulate that problem.
Right. They're saying in our community, we're not interested in trying to establish ourselves as the artists that you should pay attention to, and as like better than whatever else. In general, better. They will say they're better than commercial art, but not for reasons of distinction or sophistication or anything like that.
Right. And these are very much, I think of these as, at least the punk as being like very much into do-it-yourself mode, right? Where like, you know, you have
right.
a guitar, or maybe even not, you could play on the stage. You could start
right.
a band.
And the 60s underground is very much the same way. The idea was, you know, I can get a camera and some film, and it's not that expensive, and I can do it all myself, and I don't have to go through Hollywood, or even that sort of independent, you know, exploitation.
I have a guitar.
And you're in a band.
But and I'm in a band, but I could not play the guitar on stage to save my life.
That's because you're not living in late 70s New York City.
I guess not. But I would get it there, and people wouldn't go to my shows, let's put it that way, if I came up there and tried to play songs.
You know, the 70s pop thing is kind of the same way. I mean, television, when they first started playing very early, were apparently terrible. If you look at like some of the demos, they were terrible.
Well, here's my theory.
Yes, Chris.
I'm in an established band. It's not during the 70s in England either. So the whole thing really got going. So you know,
Bruce, does this idea that anybody should be able to create legitimate culture appeal to you?
Oh yeah, I mean. I think what makes it really great, create your own culture, is something that considers you. I mean, it sounds like different things, but it's culture. I mean, if you come out with something culture, make it your own. And if it's your own and not like. I mean, obviously, if it's like. It's like, I think a really great thing about. My band is something that we can actually literally call our own. And then culture should be the same thing. As long as it's repulsive and despicable, then hats off to those for it.
So we see all these subcultures who go out there, they create their culture, they say, we're not going to be part of like institution building, we're not going to be part of creating the official list of you know, movies you should see, books you should read, albums you should listen to, you know, we're not going to be about something that like some college professor is going to teach. But then, ha! Like, what happens?
Right.
The tables are turned.
Depends on the situation. I mean, the 60s Underground people formed their own canon, you know, Anthology Film Archives.
Talk about that. So these guys are making. Describe these films for people who don't know. Like, what would be a good example of these 60s underground films?
Well, there's a lot of different kinds. This is one of the important things. There's an enormous variety of filmmaking going on amongst these people. And there had been since at least the 20s in the U.S. a strong strand of what it's called an experimental film, but even more than sort of narrative film. It's best defined by, it's stuff that's not narrative or documentary film, although sometimes it's documentary. It's really difficult to say, I mean, you could say Kenneth Anger, Stan Brakhage, or Bruce Conner, and Maya Darren, and a whole host of other people, but if you watch any of the films by any of these people, you know, Kenneth Anger films, Bruce Conner films, and Stan Brakhage films have nothing to do with each other aesthetically.
So this is more of a mode of production or a community than it is a genre.
Very much so, okay. Yeah. I mean, that's really the most important thing about it in terms of defining it is not an aesthetic. It's not a certain style of editing, a certain style of shooting or storytelling or whatever. It's really a mode of production and a sort of community.
Would you say that to a certain extent it's defined by what it isn't? I mean, you know, it's not, you know, any of the traditional, you know, like if you go into Blockbuster Video or whatever and they have, you know, their categories of film, it's like, well, it's what would not fit into any of those.
Yeah, really, that's a very common way of thinking about it, is that it's sort of everything else.
But there also is a lot of stuff that could count as everything else that would not be thrown in with this either.
That's a good one.
But yeah, I mean, that's often a way it's described.
So these guys had their movies. They had did they have a system of screening? If you lived in New York, could you go and see these movies?
Absolutely, yeah. Jonas Mekas, who's still alive and is often referred to as the patron saint of the American underground cinema. He organized a lot of screenings, and there were a lot of other places that would have screenings, sometimes sort of one-off things, sometimes more consistently scheduled. But yeah, I mean, if you lived in New York, if you lived in San Francisco, L.A., later in the 60s, college campuses, you could watch these things.
And like Warhol too would be like part of that.
Yeah, Warhol's a really interesting figure, but absolutely, his films are integral to the underground, even though he himself kept a distance from the community, and a lot of people in the community didn't like him.
Because he was just what do you call it, a carpetbagger.
Some people, yeah, Stan Brakhage considered him a total carpetbagger, even though Brakhage kind of liked some of his films.
Even though Chelsea Girls is one of the greatest American films of the 20th century.
Sure, I mean, you could certainly make that argument. And again, Chelsea Girls was beloved by many, many people in the underground cinema, including Sam Brakhage, even though Brakhage hated a lot of his other films.
So these guys, they have their people were making their movies, men and women, all kinds of things, all kinds of genres. Some of them are like really abstract looking. Some of them are narrative. Some of them are like plays off of genre. Some of them are like funny or not funny, or, you know, some of them are like boring or really experimental or just weird in some way. And they just got all these movies. And then suddenly, out of this community comes a canon. How does this happen?
Well, it's a historical development. In the early 60s, Mekas and some other people, I mean, I refer to Mekas a lot just because he's like this important guy.
Also because he would say, Anthology Film Archives, the Cathedral of Cinema.
Right.
Which I think is awesome.
So in the early 60s, he and some other people started forming certain kinds of institutions. So they started with a thing called the New American Cinema Group that started from a more sort of documentary or sort of politically inspired narrative cinema angle, but rapidly shifted towards more strictly experimental kind of work or sort of camp kind of like Jack Smith, George Cukor kind of things. So there was that. There was his screening series, the Cinematheque. There was the Filmmakers Cooperative. There was a sort of grant system to try to get filmmakers some amount of money for making films. And then a little bit later, there's a thing called the Filmmakers Distribution Center, which tried to place films. The Filmmakers Cooperative had generally tried to place films in non-theatrical screening spaces. So universities or like art clubs or cinema clubs, that kind of thing. Filmmakers Distribution Center tried to place films in commercial theaters.
So did the creation of all these institutions sort of lift certain films or certain filmmakers up as being like, these are the ones?
The institutions themselves, not so much. The Filmmakers Cooperative had a strict policy against promoting anything.
Okay.
And anyone who wanted to could place films in it and have them rented through it. And apparently, you know, if the stories are true, and I think they probably are, if you called them and said, you know, I'm putting together a screening series, can you give me some recommendations? They would say no. We'll send you a catalog.
That's awesome. We'll send you our complete catalog.
And you pick. The Cinematheque, you know, would tend to focus on certain things, but the Cinematheque focus on a lot of different things, and it would have monthly or sometimes bi-monthly open house screenings where anybody could go and bring a can of film. It didn't even have to be a completed film. It could be whatever they wanted.
So it sounds like these institutions really valued that idea that, like, we're not going to pick who gets to be the one.
Yeah. The way in which a sort of nascent canon began to form was more through writing.
Okay.
Particularly Mekas's column in the Village Voice. He had a weekly column in the Voice called Film Journal, and there's Film Journal. Is that what it's called? I don't even remember. Anyway, there's a collection of Mekas's pieces that you can get in book form, but also through writing in a journal called Film Culture, which was kind of the magazine version of this stuff. It was, you know, sort of a film quarterly kind of thing, but it focused almost entirely on experimental film.
Now, if you go down to Anthology, which is, you know, there in the Lower East Side of New York, they have a couple of theaters there, and they have a series called Essential Cinema, which, if you're a member, you go to free, and otherwise it's a discount. And there's some kind of list around the Essential Cinema list? Is this part of this canon-forming process?
This is the, in terms of an explicit canon, this is the thing. This is the one.
anthology, the idea for anthology started to emerge in 1967, and it was finally constructed and opened in November of 1970. And right along with it was this essential cinema list. Mikus and several other people, through a very tortured series of selection committee meetings, selected roughly 300 films.
And these are not all experimental. They were the essential films.
No, they're in fact not all experimental.
Right.
Citizen Kane's on the list, Charlie Chaplin's on the list, Laurel and Hardy are on the list. But they're primarily experimental. And they're primarily American, although there are non-American films.
And so how did people react? Because, like you said, you have a culture which is so dedicated to not, you know, not forming a canon that, in fact, you know, the people who run the institutions refuse to give you suggestions of what to see.
The part of the issue was, yeah, people reacted badly. A lot of people reacted badly, not everybody. But a lot of people said, you know, why am I not in here? Or B, you know, how do you have the gall to do this in the first place? Or C, particularly later in the 70s, and particularly from an academic film theory criticism perspective, a large feminist challenge was proposed to the canon because there were a lot of major women filmmakers in the 60s who were not included in the essential cinema list.
How about, was there any reaction from, was it all white men too? Or, you know, was there any reaction to like black filmmakers or other?
As far as I can think, it was all white. The one thing about that that makes it a little bit different from the feminist challenge is there weren't really any black underground filmmakers. There was one guy who made a film, what's his name? He made one called The Cry of Jazz. Edward Bland, and he was originally in the New American Cinema Group, or in The Cry of Jazz, was heralded by Mikus in the very early 60s. But he kind of drifted away from it. And so there weren't actually any particular filmmakers of color involved in the underground cinema, at least not who I could think of.
Well, yeah, because
in that particular crowd of the underground.
Not involved in that particular crowd. And really, if there were, you know, African-American filmmakers making experimental work in the 60s, it's basically been completely forgotten. Like, no one knows who it would have been. Yeah, like I don't know of any, and this is like my research.
Okay,
I'm missing some.
Okay, but then there's like, I know that there were like black films like made as far back as the you know, like the Silent Days and that sort of thing.
Right.
But I guess they had it wasn't really. It was essentially making the same kinds of genre films as white filmmakers were, but yeah,
right.
Just for black.
Yeah, and that's the thing. For whatever, you know, historical reasons, black filmmakers did not take up experimental filmmaking really with any, to my knowledge at all, until the 70s and particularly the 80s.
Right. I know later you have like Charles Burnett and such, but it wasn't really experimental.
So I want to ask you about the punk scene then. So what subculture, what division of the punk scene were you looking at in particular?
The, you know, New York sort of, that moment from 1974 through 76, 77, when everyone started getting records released.
Okay.
And, you know, the downtown CBGBs and Max's based.
And what kind of bands are we talking about?
Television, the Ramones, Patti Smith, Talking Heads, Blondie, Richard Hell, Heartbreakers, Dead Boys sort of at the very end of this moment. Wayne County.
What, Bruce?
Who's that?
What about the Talking Heads?
Yeah, Talking Heads.
And did this subculture of bands also prize, you know, we're not going to tell you what bands are good. We're going to argue vociferously over what bands are good, but institutionally we're going to try to stay neutral, or we're going to try to celebrate everything?
By and large, the idea was, you know, if you're not making something that sounds conventional to us, you're okay.
Okay.
You know, but there was, from the beginning, more of these musicians had an eye on professional careers.
Okay.
Hmm.
And, you know, were angling to get record contracts. But the other thing about the punk scene is that it was embedded in a much larger and more diverse art scene going on in Lower Manhattan, both Lower East Side and Soho.
Okay.
And so a lot of those figures
were also, you know, were sort of forming alternative gallery spaces, things like the kitchen and that kind of stuff, that punk people didn't necessarily play a lot, but they had relationships with. And so there was this whole interconnected art scene that had, you know, sort of underground character and wasn't just everyone trying to get rich.
And so how, in that situation, or in that scene, how did you then see, how did you see a Canon form? When did this happen? How did it happen?
Well, I mean, it's very different because it wasn't, the way that a Canon may have formed, it wasn't through the artists themselves, like it was with the anthology Canon, which was filmmakers themselves making a list. Okay, it's people from within the community themselves making a list. There was a little bit of it in the writing about this stuff, like in Punk Magazine and New York Rocker. But what's interesting, particularly about New York Rocker, Punk Magazine was much more sort of Mad Magazine cartoon kind of thing. And the guys who made Punk didn't even like most of these bands. They pretty much liked the Ramones and Blondie and would kind of ignore a lot of the other bands. But the interesting thing about New York Rocker is New York Rocker covered the entire scene, not really using the word punk, usually referring to it as the sort of new New York rock scene, new downtown rock scene, something like that. And they covered a whole lot of other bands who played the same venues, would play the same bills as these sort of canonical, well-known punk bands, and they would cover them with just as much fervor and sort of completeness as, say, the Ramones would get covered, but most of those bands have completely fallen off the face of the earth, and no one knows who they are. Like Tough Darts, the Miamis, the Shirts, Milk and Cookies. There were a whole lot of these bands that were playing the same stuff and somehow got left out, even though a number of them also had records come out, major label records come out, but they somehow never made the canon.
I kind of want to hear an album by the Shirts.
Great name for a band, I gotta say. The Shirts, I think they have an album. I think I have it. You can download albums by a lot of these bands, you know, from various music blogs.
So is there a point? I mean, so it sounds like with the films that there's a point where you can say, well, the Essential Cinema List, for example, is pretty definitively and unquestionably a canon. You can say at least
right.
By that point there was a canon. Was there a similar like thing like that that people, you know, argued over and used? I mean, and we should also mention that a canon is not necessarily accepted by everyone in the community, but it's like the thing that you argue over. You know, if people are willing to argue over your list, then it's kind of like, that means it's probably something like a canon, right?
Right, because they take it to be important enough to argue over.
What'd you say, Bruce?
You know, it's a really cool list. You know, it would be really a cool name if you had if there's a band called a punk band called The Shirt, you know, it would really be a cool name for a group.
What?
The Naked Shirt.
You could have a band called The Skins, and they could, like a battle.
That's
yeah, surprise a concert against the Shirts. You could have Skins versus Shirts.
Oh, brother.
So, or how about the shirt as well? How about I blew my nose on somebody else's naked shirt? Never like peace shoe.
So I'm sorry, I'm totally distracted from the answer to my question, which was something about at what point do we know there was an early New York punk canon?
Well, my argument would be that there's not really an early New York punk canon until people start writing histories of New York punk.
Okay. So the historians
decided. Because at the time, there was certainly a lot of sort of jealousy from various groups about various things. The first CBGBs did a live at CBGB's album in 1975. They had like a big festival, like rock festival of all these bands, both the ones we're aware of now and the ones we've forgotten about. And then they did an album. The interesting thing is the album features almost entirely all those bands we don't know about, like Tough Darts and The Shirts. So you would think that album might have somehow, you know, influenced the canonization of these bands, but in fact it didn't at all. And these
it was the curse. It was the curse of that album.
The reason most of these bands were the bands that appeared on that album is because the other bands didn't want to.
They had done too much.
Most of these well-known bands had already had record contracts by then.
Okay.
And were like, or you know, almost had record contracts, and they didn't want to contribute songs to this thing.
So that was really the second string on that album.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's what you would now consider the second string, even though most journalists at the time didn't particularly make that distinction.
Hmm.
And so it's not until you get histories of New York punk like Clinton Halen's from Velvet's Devoidoids that this sort of designated set of bands, Talking Heads, Blondie, Ramones, Richard Hell's various groups, Television, Patti Smith, become the canon of New York punk rock.
So are these, and are the people writing these histories like rock critic types, or are they like academic types?
They're rock critic types.
Okay. So if Lester Banks had lived longer, he might have been the one to decide, for example.
I mean, Lester Banks also famously wasn't that into the New York punk rock scene outside of the Ramones.
I feel like most of those kinds of bands that I know about, maybe this is like the total limit of my knowledge, because I feel like so much of like that loud, weird 70s music I know totally just from like what Lester Banks happened to have written about that was republished.
Yeah, I mean, there's you know, the Clinton Halen book that I mentioned is generally considered the canonical history of New York punk. There's also a book called Please Kill Me, which is a sort of, oral history.
Then there's also just the sales. I mean, because, for example, like a lot of these bands, I became aware of in the 80s when they were, you know, when they had kind of moved on to being more pop stuff. And then, you know, I would hear, like, from my older sister or whatever, like, oh, yeah, you know, like, Blondie started off as a punk band. And I was like, wow, really? And then,
Talking Heads,
they were a punk band, you know? Like, and so it's kind of just like, well, I don't know, you know, it's like just the origins of these bands that kind of later moved on and did more popular work.
And that's certainly true with those bands. And it's sort of interesting, you know, Patti Smith, you know, went way away from things and never did great sales, but continued her music career. But
right,
also, like,
sure.
Richard Hell's stuff in Television never sold much at all.
Yeah, they never sold a lot, no.
And yet Richard Hell became, like, the New York punk. Like, if, you know, people going to designate one guy as the New York punk, it'd be Richard Hell.
And he actually was the one who had that shirt that said, Please Kill Me.
He had the famous Please Kill Me shirt. He supposedly was the first guy to wear a torn T-shirt on stage. This is the
claim. Number one had a what on stage?
Torn T-shirt, like, supposedly Richard Hell himself is really self-aggrandizing, and he claims to be the guy who Malcolm McLaren stole all of the Sex Pistols style from.
Oh,
you know, Malcolm McLaren managed the New York Dolls in their final incarnation and saw the sort of beginnings of this punk thing and saw Richard Hell and blah blah blah.
Is this why the shirts were called the shirts, because they were mocking Richard Hell's obsession with bragging about his different shirts?
I don't know anything about the shirt. There's literally no historical information about the shirts in the world.
You know, I remember when Mike Benedetti wore a shirt that said "Pretense Sells" on it.
That was my attempt to make a fake late 70s punk shirt. I was very pleased with the way that shirt turned out.
And
What, Bruce?
I said Blondie's now it's called In the Moment or something like that now.
Wait, they changed their name or they just have a new album?
Yeah. They just called to change the name.
I didn't know about this.
You know how old Deborah Harry is?
I'm going to say 60s.
Like, she's like far older than you would think. She's like, okay,
she's like five. Yeah, something like that.
She was a rather old woman when they formed the band.
Yeah, she was like 30.
Yeah.
That's old.
I mean, not old, but old for that scene.
Old for somebody starting a band, yeah.
Younger than everyone
on
this call.
A lot of people on that scene were older than people would think. You know, people often think of punk as this very youthful, you know, snotty teenager thing, and it wasn't at all in that era.
Yeah, I mean, she was old for Saturday Groove. I mean, people that age, people are young, they didn't die at that age because they're busy going up the deep end. So
I want to ask you about the third,
okay.
thing.
I'm looking at Debbie Harry's 64. So she was 30 already in 1975. Yeah.
Mark Benedetti, No Wave, the No Wave film movement.
Uh-huh.
Permanent Vacation. Other films.
What?
Other films.
Work by Eric Mitchell, such as Kidnapped in Red Italy.
Okay.
A film called Rome 78 by James and Ayres, which is amazing. John Lurie made a film called Men in Orbit. It was the only film he directed, and it's great.
John Lurie, who is from Whistler?
John Lurie. I didn't know that.
I believe it's true.
A number of films by these people, Beth and Scott B. A number of films by a woman named Vivian Dick.
some stuff by this guy named Charlie Ahern.
And these guys are working in the 80s.
These guys are working in the very late 70s into the 80s.
Okay.
There's also a guy named Amos Poe, who now teaches filmmaking at NYU, who was a sort of precursor to these people, who started making films. His first film was called Blank Generation. Well, his first feature film was called Blank Generation, and it's a documentary about CBGBs. It's just a total performance documentary, 1975.
And this scene, like the New York punk scene, like I think we've all heard of stuff from the avant-garde film scene. Like at least people will probably, culturally literate people have at least know something about Warhol's films. And, you know, like us, for example, not being all huge film fans, have seen many of these films, the Brackage and the whatevers.
Yeah.
The No Wave films, I feel like, way more obscure.
Very obscure. I agree.
In this scene, so what happens with this scene? How do they, what is their attitude towards mainstream success or creation of a canon or whatever?
They were all artists of some kind or other who were interested in film as, you know, just another sort of medium. None of them really were trying to get film careers.
Even
Jarmusch, when he started, wasn't particularly interested in that. And their attitude is actually, if you were going to pick one major influence, it's probably going to be Warhol's films.
Okay.
His sort of pre-Chelsea Girls films. Eric Mitchell's films are pretty much all, like, almost ripped off of Warhol. A lot funnier, but...
Would he essentially just, you know, like, park a camera somewhere and have people do things in front of the camera, and then when the...
Yeah, well, his film Kidnapped is sort of a really crappy version of A Clockwork Orange. Which Warhol had done Vinyl, which was his own version of Clockwork Orange. But actually, the camera is positioned, it's kind of like a security camera, so it kind of pans back and forth, like the end of the conversation. And it's just like people milling about in the room, and there's like one guy kind of like in a corner somewhere that people will occasionally go over and like hit. It's like he's, you know. But it's mostly just people milling about and talking about whatever, talking about parties, talking about drugs. Doing nothing. It's about an hour long.
This sounds a ton like Chelsea Girls.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit like Chelsea Girls with it, you know. But it doesn't really focus on individuals like Chelsea Girls does.
So what is the attitude in this community towards the creation of official stuff, institutions, canons, critics, lists?
There was basically no... I don't even... You know, as far as I can tell, this is the one thing there's very little written about. And very little, you know, even archival materials about. But, you know, in general, these people had no interest in institutions. There was one short-lived screening space for them called the New Cinema. There was a storefront theater on St. Mark's that lasted like 10 months in 1978.
Okay.
And people would just show whatever, but it closed and no one particularly cared, as far as I can tell. And they would mostly show films at people's houses, at bars, at CBGBs, occasionally expanding out beyond that.
Is Liquid Sky one of these movies?
Liquid Sky is not one of these movies, as far as I know.
Okay. Anyway, sorry for that.
But so, I mean, and it was such a, you know, and some of these people went on to continue making films into the 80s. And some of them, Beth B. particularly, went on to make a very different kind of film. She made these sort of art, narrative, political films later on. And then the scene also kind of got revitalized in the 80s in what became known as the cinema of transgression, with people like Richard Kern and Nick Zedd. But that was a different kind of thing, even though it was in some ways a continuation of the No Wave thing.
But they were more transgressive.
Yeah, I mean, those films, if you've ever seen Nick Zedd, those films are actually much... A, there's a book about them, but they're also more readily available. Richard Kern and Nick Zedd each have DVDs, whereas almost all of these No Wave films are not in official release on video, although you can obtain them on video.
So then, did these guys ever get a canon, the Noah? I mean, obviously, like, you would say Jim Jarmusch, whatever he made, you would have to say is canonical, because he's gone on to be, like, a great filmmaker, make wonderful films like Dead Man and Ghost.
His Primitive Vacation is often not considered part of the No Wave, seen by historians. And you know, the canon of No Wave filmmakers, there were other people who I haven't mentioned who were involved in this filmmaking, who got equal press, or pretty much equal press, from whatever few outlets actually wrote about them in the late 70s, who have not shown up in the couple of recent histories of No Wave. There's a book by Martin Masters called No Wave that devotes a chapter to No Wave cinema. And there's a book by Byron Coley and Thurston Moore, maybe somebody else,
that came out a year or two ago that also talked about New Wave cinema. And the people I mentioned are the people who get mentioned in these histories, but there were other people who were considered just as much a part of this who don't get mentioned in those histories as well. So, you know, if punk was the canon partly formed by what became popular and thus known, that didn't happen with No Wave film. Whatever semblance of a canon there is entirely due to like one or two books.
Okay. So, I have a few questions that I wanted to ask. I guess, first of all, so I know a lot of people who do underground art stuff and who are part of underground culture and really value that. And I think that the DIY aesthetic is still really alive. The idea that, the people who are playing are then going to immediately like get off the stage and be with the crowd, and there's not going to be a big division there necessarily. Are there strategies that you can do to prevent the formation of a canon if your subculture is interested in doing that, in preventing that?
I'm not sure you necessarily want to prevent the institution of a canon, and this is one of my points, is that people always badmouth the canon, like, oh, that's terrible. And yet, as you just said, there are still plenty of people making underground films, underground music, whatever. It's not like those canons that formed somehow killed off underground film or underground music.
Right. Some people say, oh, these guys all, it's like a sellout, or it somehow hurts people because it suddenly lifts some people up, you know, and other people then are relatively lower down, and it's not fair.
And sure, that causes certain kinds of problems, but there's this very common argument in cultural studies, the resistance and co-optation model, that has held strong and still holds strong in certain quarters, even though some people have kind of attacked a little bit, but from a different direction.
What is that model?
And it always says, oh, these kind of things get, you know, they're resistant in whatever way, politically, culturally, socially, whatever, and then they become co-opted, and either by an industry, you know, by commercial industry, or by something like a canon, by institutionalization.
Right.
But it's
some
not,
college
they,
professor
I mean,
or some advertising.
They very patently don't, because, you know, punk still is, as quote-unquote sold out as punk is, Hot Topic and Warped Tour and whatever.
Also dead. Punk is also dead, by the way.
Right, punk is, of course, dead. You know, obviously punk is still a very vibrant thing. It's still very inspirational to a lot of people culturally and politically. You know, it still holds water, even though it does a lot of other things, too.
It's maybe not as radical.
Yeah, I mean, you know, all around the country, there's little tiny scenes of, you know, bands that form from high school kids and, you know, play a few shows around a handful of venues and stuff. I mean, we had that, you know, where I grew up, and then I'm sure there was, you know, some kind of a scene and, you know, just about everywhere.
Yeah, we definitely have that around here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a thing that is done, even though maybe it's in different ways or whatever. It's not like the canonization of 70s New York punk somehow ended punk for good, and it's only
so there's maybe this
boy,
there's maybe this thing with punk that, you know, punk may not be this impregnable fortress that you would like it to be, but it's still a mighty army. That's maybe a better way. That punk can be co-opted, but punk is also durable nonetheless, which is actually kind of badass.
I mean, so is metal. I mean, that's supposedly badass, too.
Yeah, I mean, you could say the same thing about, you know, metal or even hip-hop. Like, people argue, oh, hip-hop is just all, you know, whatever, you know, D-Diddy or something.
It's not the same thing to say that something is in the canon and to say that something is one of the best. I mean, like if you were to ask me to come up with a list of 100... what I would call essential American films, and then if you also ask me to come up with a list of 100 of what I just consider the best American films, it wouldn't be the same list.
Well, right, and because whenever you're thinking about essential, you're thinking about historical elements.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. You know, something that at least shows a, will help, you know, show, okay, this is what people were doing in this one particular kind of area. This is what, and,
right.
You know, I'll have, you know, particular subgenres or whatever that I like a lot, and I'll be like, yeah, you know, so sue me. I put in, you know, 10 Kubrick movies or whatever.
Right.
Like, but I wouldn't necessarily say they're all essential.
So it's like all film fans should see The Ghost of Mr. Chicken, but that's not to say The Ghost of Mr. Chicken is necessarily, you know, it represents a vital form of cinema, but it does not necessarily mean it's like a great form of cinema.
And this is, I mean, this touches on, you know, a strong strand of my dissertation, the sort of the concept of taste and the relationship between taste and history and the relationship between taste and social distinction and class distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the canon is so often accused of being, well, A, these guys like it or whatever, and they're trying to sort of force this on us. And so part of my argument is with these canons is the problem is not even what went into the canon. The problem for undergrounds is so often just the canonical form itself and the baggage that a canonical form has, because the canonical form is so strong, you know, the sort of invention of a canon of any art is really strongly influenced by a sort of Kantian theory of taste and judgment that continues to have a really, really strong influence.
Wait a second. Why is it Kantian?
Well, it's Kantian because it's always read as you have to sort of dehistoricize it somehow. I mean, one of the things about Kantian taste and the sort of legacy of the Kantian version of taste that remains sort of our dominant version of taste is exactly what Adam was just referring to. You know, his tastes are X number of films, but the quote-unquote important films is a different list. Because when you express things as important in a really curious way, you're supposed to both propose a sort of trans-historical value for them, but you also are sort of implicitly addressing their historical value, their historical significance. So while Kant's mode of taste and the sort of post-Kantian mode of taste is very much about, we're not interested in sort of the historical importance of this thing. And this is exactly what the statement of the essential cinema people was. It was, we do not look at historical factors. We looked only at formal elements to figure out what was the best. We didn't look at influences. They claim to have not looked at any of that. But, of course, you have to look at that, and you can't not look at that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the things about a canon is people assume that it is a dehistoricized thing, both the people who make it and the people who sort of look at it. But yet it's never a dehistoricized thing. And so there's this tension between, and this is what I'm getting into in the punk chapter that I'm currently writing, between sort of temporality of taste as an individual practice and the temporality of a canon and sort of the historical temporality of a canon.
So here's what I want to ask you. Answer the question of the title, what can a canon do? Because people are going to be looking at this book in the bookstore or whatever, and they're going to be saying, okay, they're going to be flipping to the back, like, okay, I need to know the answer.
On the stacks in Walmart, the big prominent display.
He'll be down at Kroger's in the book aisle.
Yeah, I hope it's in Walmart, yeah.
So what is it? So what's the answer? What can a canon do? Or is it just like a funny title?
No, I mean, I'm taking it as a real thing. It's inspired by Spinoza's old question, what can a body do? Or his claim, you know, we do not know what a body can do. Because
Wait a second. I think
that people... What?
Why can't we know what a body can do?
What he means is we know some of the things a body can do, but that a body is essentially infinite in potential. And so I think that...
You mean like a human
body? We don't know yet.
You mean like the human body?
With Spinoza, it can be difficult to tell. Spinoza and then, you know, his subsequent... The people he influenced, like Deleuze, tend to use the word body in a much broader sense.
Okay.
Ultimately, physics would use the word body.
Like three-body problem.
But a piece of music could be a body.
All right. Well, I'm willing to stipulate that Spinoza did not, or that Spinoza knows why we can't know what a body can do. So you're saying the same way that we can't know what a canon can do,
what I'm saying is we have not adequately. People who have thought canons, A, have almost always restricted themselves to canons of, you know, already established art. So when people, you know, the famous canon wars of the 80s, right? I assume you're familiar with this.
This is like, what's-his-face, that old guy?
Yeah, well, where the whole dead old white guy trip comes from.
Yeah.
Right. But this struggle was entirely over sort of major literature.
And this is sort of over who are we going to teach in college English class? Who are we going to say are the important writers?
Right. And it would have completely ignored something like the underground cinema. If you had the same kind of argument about film, you would always be talking about Hollywood and then European art cinema and blah, blah, blah. That kind of argument would completely ignore the canon of something like underground film, which pretty much flew under the radar for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm arguing, part of what I'm arguing is canon in underground films is fundamentally a different thing to argue over than a canon of, you know, high art, quote-unquote, literary stuff, or, you know, Renaissance painting or whatever. And that its effects are different because of the communities involved, because of the politics of the work being produced, and because of what a lot of the people making this work were trying to do, as well as the fact that it was a canon formed, you know, really early in the history of this stuff.
All of these things?
It would be, I mean, think about it, the canon came out in 1970. The earliest things in the canon are from 19, I think the earliest thing is probably, well, I guess Lumiere and Méliès films from the 1890s. That's only 80 years after the first things in the canon appeared. Can you imagine someone trying to form a canon 80 years after people started writing books?
Maybe they had one, but it's been lost.
Well, maybe, but, the point is the canons that people argue about in every other art form, except I suppose for narrative film, which is similar, are canons that are about, you know, centuries and even millennia of writing,
mm-hmm.
or of painting or of whatever.
Yeah.
So it's really odd to say we're going to form a canon now and it's going to have something from 2 years ago in it.
Do you think people start forming a canon whenever there's like suddenly so much stuff available that you're sure that people are asking you for advice a lot? Like if you're in an era where you can only get your hands on a dozen books, like it doesn't make any sense to have a canon of books because it's like, you know,
right.
You can read all the books you want. Yeah.
This is another big thing, and it wasn't so much that you couldn't have watched all of the underground films, because they really, I mean, you look at the filmmaker's cooperative catalog from 1967, there's maybe 500 films in it. Most of them are like five minutes long.
But if you have to write away for them?
You could see, you had to pay for them, but there actually was, this is another important thing that people often ignore when they think about how horrible the Essential Cinema List was. There already was kind of a de facto canon, because in the late 60s, universities and art guilds and that kind of thing gained interest in these kinds of films, so they didn't know where to start. And they couldn't go to the cooperative, because the cooperative would say, here's the catalog, pick what you want. So they would call people like Jonas Mekas and P. Adam Sidney and say, what should we get? And those guys would say, here's what we like. And they actually started getting one of the things that Mekas has said is they actually started getting so many calls that they were like, well, why don't we just make a list? And we'll send it to people so we don't have to keep fielding all these calls.
Ah.
And so that's one of the important origins of this canon that people had kind of ignore in
time
the
saving.
They make of it.
I see that a lot in like some people say like what comic books should I read first? And be like, well, okay. And you're limited to what's available for one thing, if it's something that's never been reprinted from 1985 and it's not widely available, then, they won't have it. But, you can at least say, okay, read The Dark Knight Returns, read Watchmen, et cetera.
Right.
And, read these. These will give you an introduction to the form. These will be, I think that these are good examples of the form,
Right.
It's kind of a way of filtering through things and saying, where should I start? What will get me interested in this?
Yeah, and the difference between that and a canon is that you can also add the addendum, but there's a bunch of other stuff too.
Right.
You canon, you kind of can't.
Yeah, true. Yeah,
you establish a canon in 1970. By 1980, a lot of people have seen the whole thing because anthology screened the whole thing all the time. So now they need more stuff, and the canon doesn't offer anything more. Now, they intended for the thing to be revised on a fairly regular basis, and they added stuff once in 1975, but that was it.
Well, guys, I think we've got to wrap up the show. Mark, thanks for your time. Adam and Bruce, thanks for your time.
Mark.
Mark, I want to ask you a question that I oftentimes ask you when we see each other in person. What's a movie that I haven't seen that I should see? Speaking of canons.
What's a movie that you have, any particular genre?
First one that comes to mind.
Did you ever see Divine Intervention, the Elia Suleiman film?
No.
See that. It's on DVD.
Awesome.
Make sure you get the Suleiman one. There's several ones called Divine Intervention that are on DVD. Make sure you get that one.
Everyone, thanks for listening to the Snow Ghost Community Podcast. Mike Benedetti, Adam Villani, Mark Benedetti, Bruce Russell.
Bye, Warbonds!
We'll talk to you guys later. Bye-bye.